Welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
To me, being perfect is not about that scoreboard out there.
This is a chance of a lifetime.
When you can understand the person, you can then work towards a common goal.
We are all on the same team.
Know your role and do it to the best of your ability.
Focus on the fundamentals. We've gone over time and time again.
Your defense has got to be better.
Leave no doubt tonight.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
Hello and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast, where we believe that there is no algorithm for leadership, and so we interview great sports coaches from around the world to try and find ideas to help all of us be better leaders. Our great coach on this episode is Andy Shea. Andy is a former lacrosse player who started coaching as an assistant under Greg Kinnella at the University of Massachusetts, where he helped the team win three New England titles. Then in 2003, he was named the head coach of Yale, where he has gone on to lead the team to the 2018 NCAA championship, five Ivy tournament titles, and three regular season Ivy League championships. Under his leadership, the team has also regained the number one national ranking for the first time since 1883. In this terrific interview, some of the key highlights for me were Andy's description of the compound effect, which shapes both his coaching and parenting philosophy, and the importance of habits within this philosophy. The team trademark, ONE, which stands for Only Need Everyone, that the team used to guide their collective efforts, and how this trademark has stayed with his athletes as they have gone out into the world and taken on leadership positions. And the way he talks about eating your vegetables at training. This was an enjoyable interview with Andy, who sits in one of the world's best learning organisations, and I hope you enjoyed as much as we did. And just before we go to the interview, if you would like to know more about what we do, head over to thegreatcoachespodcast.com, where you will find exclusive audio and video content, as well as our insights database that contains 1 to 2 minute videos from all of the guests we have interviewed on leadership topics like conflict, communication, and culture. You can download them, share them, and hopefully get a conversation going that brings a different context to the challenges your team is facing. And now, please enjoy our interview with Andy Shea.
You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
So, Andy Shea, good afternoon and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Well, good afternoon to you. It's morning here, so.
Well, why don't you tell us where you are in the world, actually, and what you've been up to so far today?
I'm in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm a head lacrosse coach at Yale University. And most of the morning, I'm worked with our engineering school, developed some new technology for our sport, which is one of the great things about working at Yale. And then did a little bit of work with admissions, trying to get kids into this great institution.
Well, we're going to talk about Yale as we go along, and we might talk a little bit about innovation as well. But I wouldn't mind just starting, Andy, with some of the great coaches you've had experience with, because I've been learning all about lacrosse in preparation for today's interview, and I know that you've worked with some of the best. There's Bob Schillinglaw, there's Jack Emma, and there's Greg Kinnella as well. And I'm wondering, from this perspective, working up close with these great coaches in lacrosse, what do you think great coaches do differently that sets them apart?
Well, I mean, I think those two of those guys were mentors for mine, and Jack Emma in a distant. A little bit this, I didn't work under him, but Bob Schillinglaw and Greg Kinnella, I just feel unbelievably fortunate to have worked with those guys who were so important in my formative coaching years. You know, when you're in your 20s, you get into this because you love the sport. And then I think if you're smart enough, you realize very quickly that you don't really know anything about the game, or at least enough. And, you know, I think the more I do it, the more I think I probably know less than I did the day before. But you know, Bob Schillinglaw is a walking Wikipedia of lacrosse. He's just an incredible guy to learn under. Once again, realizing that you don't necessarily know as much as you thought you knew. And then, you know, Greg Kinnella is a mark of consistency that I really haven't seen since, and I don't think I'll see again. He's just an incredibly focused and consistent leader that the both of them are very far apart from each other in terms of their approach to the game. But I think that, like I said, I I'd love to think that I've taken equal amounts from both and landed right in the middle with my kind of my model.
If I could follow up, Andy, because you come from a family of seven with five boys. Now, I'm wondering, I know that must have been quite a competitive back garden when it came to sports activities, but I'm wondering how that experience has gone on and shaped you now as a coach.
Well, honestly, of the five boys, I'm the weakest athlete of all of them, of all seven of them. My sisters didn't really play many sports, but, you know, by most measures, I was the weakest athlete of all of them. And it allowed me, I should say, it forced me when I found the game of lacrosse to kind of sink my teeth into that and kind of make my own path that wasn't, you know, in the shadow of my brother. So I think that without that, you know, they didn't play lacrosse. They played football, basketball, and baseball. I played football and a little bit of basketball. And just when I found this sport, I was in my sophomore year in high school and decided that, you know, it was what I wanted to do. It was something that I could do better than them because they didn't do it. So, you know, I developed in college as a player and then realized that I wasn't done with the sport and started coaching.
Well, actually, I wanted to talk to you about your decision to coach because your father was the basketball coach in your hometown, but he was also the DA. Now, I understand he's a very important role model to you, but how did he react when you told him you wanted to be a career coach?
It's something I look back on, really amazing, the level of trust that he had in me to do this. And you know, when you first start college coaching, you're not making any money. You're not making any money for a number of years. So he realized that maybe I thought I wanted to be a lawyer like him. I mean, I wanted to, you know, when I started coaching, I thought that I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to be a coach. And, you know, I was making almost no money in the, you know, in the school that I was at and wasn't projected to make a ton of money, you know, anytime soon. But right away, he and my mother were just like, this is your path. It's what you should do. And he supported it 100%. One of the things he did say was that if he could go back in time, he would just coach rather than go to law school. And you know, I think that for him, his passion was law, but I think he thoroughly got more out of coaching than, I should say, being the DA. I think that it was a chance to work with people and impact lives, and he was really good at it. I try and liken him. The picture I can paint of him is that he, you know, if you've seen the movie To Kill a Mockingbird, the Gregory Peck's character, Atticus Finch, that's what he was like as a lawyer, starkly similar. And as a coach, he's a former Marine, and you could hear it in his voice when he coached. So, you know, in my coaching path, I've just kind of, when I first started, I thought I'd try and emulate him in terms of how to carry myself and how to direct the team. And it's been an impersonation the entire way.
Well, you started out being an assistant coach. You worked your way up, and I've read how you were doing a lot of part-time jobs to make ends meet as you were moving along. But you get to Yale in 2003. And you take the team back to the number one rank in the country. Now, what's interesting is that the last time they were number one was in 1883, which is really quite crazy. What were the early decisions you took that helped fuel that result?
When I looked at the job, I was the assistant coach at UMass under Greg Cannella. And when you're coming up, you want to be a head coach. And looking at all the head coaching opportunities, for some reason, the ones that fascinated me more than others would be the ones that look like a bigger challenge. And, you know, when I looked at the Yale job, it opened up, not a lot of people wanted it. And to be honest, I'm not sure my soon to be boss wanted me. I think I joke that I was the sixth choice out of five guys. But I think one of the reasons people didn't want the job when I applied for it is that it just hadn't had a ton of success in over 130 years of history. So I think in 130 years, they had something like, I think, 9 double digit win seasons, which to me couldn't be more fascinating. Like if this could, you know, could you get it to that level? And as a single guy and not having to provide for a family at the time, I was completely all in. And I married my wife, had a couple kids, had some losing seasons, and started to freak out that I probably should have thought this through a little bit more. But in 2010, it started to work out a little bit. And then we made some strides working towards that goal of multiple double-digit win seasons. And here we are.
Well, here we are indeed, because, of course, in 2018, you win the NCAA championship. But yeah. I was actually reading an interview with one of your ex-players, Ryan McQuaidy. I think I pronounced that correct. And he said that the team had a slogan, and it was one, only need everybody. And I it sort of caught my eye a little bit, and I was wondering if you could tell us about it.
The number one is representative of a million things in our program. We talk about one play at a time and acting as one, and one ground ball, one goal, one play that you know may or you know may turn the game for you in a positive manner. And we also I have a kind of a pet peeve that we try and coach as best we can. We try and coach the last three guys harder than or as hard as the guys who, you know, get to play. These guys that are on the end of your roster, they go through, they eat their vegetables just like everybody else. They don't get to enjoy dessert like the starters do. You know what I mean? And we feel like those guys become more important as your season goes on, because if they give up and decide not to eat their vegetables in practice, then your team starts to suffer. So, you know, we try and coach those guys and we try and impress upon them and feel very strongly that they are as important, if not more important, than the top end of your roster. And for years, we would say that we need everybody. And then one day, I don't know where I was or what when it happened, but it just, the acronym kind of popped in my head. I think it was maybe we're making a t-shirt or poster, who knows. And I thought we only need everybody. That's the acronym right there. And we've, since every huddle we break down, it's, you know, one on three, and it's on almost every piece of clothing that we have. And my former players sign off their emails with that. It's kind of cool. So it's just been an overarching theme, and it just kind of fits, that acronym kind of fits to what we do.
And have those players, as they've left you and gone out into the world, have they taken it and applied it into their own lives?
Yeah, I get a lot of that. You know, I get some text messages and some, you know, emails sometimes in the middle of the night saying, I can't believe how much this is applied to what, you know, what I do now. You know, guys in the, you know, at Wall Street, or, you know, guys in that have become doctors and those types of things. It's just kind of, it's pretty humbling to hear that from someone who's, you know, chosen a profession that I can't even wrap my head around. And they, you know, they're applying the things that we did in practice.
I've heard you talk actually a lot about the importance of self-direction and self-motivation, but like you just referenced then, I imagine the people that go to Yale are all high achievers. They're all
right.
Very, very focused on succeeding in their chosen fields. But is there a risk that their drive to succeed and be the best could be misdirected when they're at college?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I felt like that was a stumbling block for us when we were trying to get this moving a little bit more, is that these are kids that end up here that have been the top 1% of everything they've ever done. And I think it's probably a shock to the system when they aren't maybe doing as well in school as they'd normally done, or winning every game that they've always done, or scoring all the goals or whatever. So I think that at this place in particular, it's a difficult transition if kids hit failure, you know, if they struggle a little bit. And to your point, you want to assign your kind of your self-worth to things that you're successful in. You don't want to be beating your head against the wall and not being successful. So, you know, early on, if we were going through a season where we weren't necessarily going to be in line to go to the NCAA tournament, some kids could get distracted and attach their identity to something that wasn't part of lacrosse or part of academics or whatever. So what you get at a place like this is kids that are extremely high achievers, like you said, but yes, if you hit a skid, you got to be able to bring them back, which is sometimes tricky here.
Andy, the compound effect is a core part of your coaching philosophy, and I understand also your parenting approach too. Can you tell us about it?
It's a book that we got introduced to our program a number of years ago. We try not to focus too far ahead. We try and focus on the one practice that's ahead of you and just try and get a little bit better every single day. And that book has we can point to lessons through the course of our season that validate Darren Hardy's book. We can tell when we're going to maybe underachieve in a game on the basis of the condition of the locker room. You know, if our guys have decided to get a little bit sloppy in how they put things away in the locker room, then, you know, we can tell that we've got a loss coming or a game where we're going to underachieve. Similarly, if our details are buttoned up over the course of, you know, in our locker room, and then for a given week of practice, we know that we've got a chance to overachieve relative to our talent on game day. And we talk about getting better every day. It's such a cliche in coaching, but the more you're in it and the more you go through this, you realize it's just so unbelievably valuable. And when I first started here, we spent so much time focused on our opponent, and we would take practice time to scout the opponent and do all these things. And it just, over time, you would get worse. You know, your team would get worse, and you start to realize that really shouldn't be the focus. And it's simple and it's cliche, but it's cliche for a reason. So, you know, we constantly present examples to these guys, like, are you getting better today? Is it tangible? Is it measurable? Is it something that you've worked on all week and will continue to work on as the season goes on? And, you know, I think for us, we've been known to lose games early in the season and, you know, thrive late in the season. And the evidence is in our path over the course of that year. We're a much better team in April and May than we're ever in February. It's not even close.
And if someone was listening and they wanted to apply this compound effect just to their own life, to just get a little better, where would you advise them to start?
I think that your habits, you know, when you get up in the morning, you know, what I try and do every day, and I'm embarrassed to say this because I feel like your life is just a series of falling short a little bit every day. You know what I mean? But I think that I try and keep habits every day I try and do five things as soon as I get to the office every day that I don't want to do, you know, and I try and make sure that I create a little bit of momentum every day to do the things, the analogy, like I said, eat my vegetables in a work setting that's going to benefit me down the road. Because it's, you know, there's the adage that you're going to suffer one way or another. It's either the suffer of discipline or the suffering of regret. So I try and do those things. But once again, I feel like I look back on it, I'm like, I'm just not doing a good enough job of that every day. It's a difficult balance, but I try.
Andy, when you talk about your expectations of the players, you say, and this is a quote, toughness and commitment and being honest with yourself, that I'm really not telling ghost stories. I love the idea of not telling yourself ghost stories. It caught my eye when I was looking at it. And I was wondering, is there an example you can share where you worked with someone to help them improve by getting past the ghost stories they were telling themselves?
Well, I think in with reference to that, it's like anything, it's got a multitude of examples, but our ghost stories are what it's going to take to thrive here. Like, we're not joking about the amount of lifting that we're going to need out of these guys. We're not joking about the amount of academic work that this place is going to take, that this is going to be one of the hardest things you're going to go through, but on the other end is going to be an incredible experience. So the ghost stories, so to speak, are what we say about the process once they're recruited. Because when we recruit here, you know, it's Yale University, and it's now it's a program that's pretty high achieving program. So those things are very, they're highly sought after, and kids could lie to themselves and say, I'm okay with the hard part. I just want that. I want a great job when they get out of college, and I want to win a lot of lacrosse games, but we want to make sure that they understand that the things you have to do to contribute to that, those successes are pretty, pretty difficult, and it's going to challenge you, and it's not going to be easy. You know, we have a saying in our office, anybody that walks out of the Rocky movies thinks they want to be a boxer for a few hours until they get punched in the face and they're like, this isn't what I want to do. So it's easy to be fired up about that once you're just finished watching the training montage. But if you really want to be a part of this program, are you going to lift as much as you need to lift and do the things academically that you're going to need to do to thrive here? And are you going to be able to run through a tough ground ball? And are you going to be able to, you know, keep all this up if you're not actually playing? Are you going to be one of these last three guys in the roster that contributes to the overall culture of our place? So that's more in reference to that.
I'm interested, Andy, what kind of relationship do you need to have with these young men so that you're able to push and challenge them as you just described and then ultimately win a national championship?
Yeah, you know, I think that we try and, once again, a model of what my father did. He's really hard on us and really hard on his players, but there's an intrinsic desire for them to succeed. And I think if those young men see that, then they can appreciate where you're coming from when you're hard on them. And we want every guy to make it through the program and succeed and you know, have it as a big part of their development and a big part of their identity here at Yale. They're not mercenaries. They're not showing up to win lacrosse games for the institution. They're here to make it part of their kind of their learning process. And that's how I genuinely feel. And I think that I don't always verbalize it to the guys, but, you know, anytime a young man is met with friction here. That's kind of how we bring them around. Like, listen, this is about developing your whole self. Like, it's not, you might not be, the odds are you're not going to be the guy that scores all the goals for us, no matter who you are. Even if you're our best player, you might not be that guy. And it's really not about that. It's about getting better every day and helping move this program along to the point where we can win again, win the whole thing again.
And what are you doing at the minute, Andy, to try and get a little bit better every day? What's on the top of your development plan?
Well, we're trying to think of new ways to play in the off season that are a little bit creative. We play, I don't know if you know much about box lacrosse, but it's a smaller field. We play in a gym. It's a restrained learning theory, which is a compound effect and talent coder. If I could have two books, that would be, and only two books, that would be one of them. So right now we're messing with the shape of the goal that we shoot on. So what we'll do is we want guys to finish a certain way. We're going to change the shape of the goal and make it a little bit different so that we get them to shoot and try and finish a different way, which is a little different than just a square 6x6 goal.
Andy, I've got another quote from you, actually, and I'd like to read it to you before I ask you the question. You say, "I really don't think of it in terms of leadership, to be honest with you, and I don't know why. But when I hear those phrases and when I hear people talk about it, I feel kind of uncomfortable." And I was really intrigued because you've got such a leadership position. You're influencing your program. You're influencing a lot of these young men who are in the team. But why does this concept of leadership make you feel uncomfortable?
I don't know. Maybe it comes from my respect for that term. And you work at a place like this, you coach these young men, and then over the course of their 4 years, you start to realize that they're going to do things that you don't have the capacity for. And it turns into this very humbling kind of position relative to them. That these guys are going to be leaders of the world, titans of industry, and they're going to cure diseases, and they're going to do things that just mind-blowing. And I think that I do recognize that I'm in a position of leadership. I get that. But I think I have a lot of respect for these young men that come through here, what they've done. I mean, I couldn't have gone to Yale. You know what I mean? That's just not me. I think that if I'm a small part in their development, then that'd be great. But I look at it as a small part, I guess, maybe. Maybe that's misplaced and unfair to me, but that's kind of how I look at it.
When these young men email you in the middle of the night, when they message you, when they talk about the impact of their time with you, how do they describe the legacy you've left on them?
Well, I got a young man who's, one of our best players of all time, just sent me a text the other night just saying that he's in his neurosurgery portion of his medical school. He said, "I can't believe how the details are more important to you than they were to people in this field," which is mind-blowing to him and mind-blowing to me. And maybe that's just his perspective, but I think that we talk about details a lot here, and I thought that was really humbling and amazing for him to write that. I think that I'm sure there's some over-romanticizing his lacrosse experience. Maybe I don't think that the details in a lacrosse game are as important as they are in neurosurgery, but might have been a little bit of a trying to give me a little bit of a boost. I don't know, but it's certainly nice to hear that that's something that we talked about in his playing days, and he's looking back upon what he learned fondly and saying that it's helping him in medical school.
I wonder if it's got something to do with the physical and the mental toughness that you coach. I mean, I know physical toughness is very important in your program. You talk about it a lot. I've seen videos where you talk about it, and it must be very easy to measure physical toughness. I mean, how much you bench press, how much you squat, but mental toughness must be different. It must be harder to measure and harder to understand. How do you go about really getting to the heart of where someone is mentally?
Well, I think we try and coach that. We try and teach that. I think it's something that is a learned skill. I think physical toughness to a certain extent is a learned skill as well, but I think mental toughness without question. We try and put them in positions where, you're down two goals and we have to collectively respond with mental toughness that's going to earn us two and eventually three goals to win the game. So we are putting them in those positions constantly, but we start with a pretty developed piece of clay when we recruit, because we talk so much about how difficult it's going to be, the strain on them, and we have them watch practice, and we're not we're not better than anybody else with how we do this. I hate to talk like this, like we're the toughest team. We're not. We're just trying not to be, you know, a soft team and a weak team. But we talk about it as much as we do because it's important in recruiting. We want to make sure our guys understand that it's going to be difficult. And the kids that sign up for that, I think, have it in them a little bit more, and they're able to be coached to be that type of mentally tough player that you need. And, you know, like I said, in the recruiting process, we talk about it so much because we want them to be honest with themselves and say, yeah, this is exactly what I want, or no, it's not. Nobody's signing up for an ice cream social to come play lacrosse here. It's going to be difficult, and we want to make sure that they go in with both eyes open. And invariably, one or two guys was fooling themselves along the way, but hopefully they make it through.
Andy, it's been great to spend an hour with you tonight chatting. I appreciate your time. I've loved hearing about lacrosse, and I'll be watching on fondly from afar to see how Yale go this season. So all the best for the games ahead.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great. Appreciate it.
Hi, everyone. You have been listening to the great coach, Andy Shea. And I hope you found a few ideas that you can bring to your own dinner table, locker room, or boardroom table for discussion. Some of the other key highlights for me were Andy's view that he wants his athletes to develop their identity at Yale through a focus on their learning journey. How he works with his student athletes, many of whom are high achievers in life and sport, when they first experience the shock to the system of joining his program. And the role his father played, who is a DA and an ex-Marine, in shaping his approach to coaching and life. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And just before we go, if you have any feedback, then please let us know. Just like Narelle Duggan, who said, "What a great podcast. Thanks to all involved and to Michael Boll for being so generous with sharing your experiences." Thanks, Narelle. The interaction with the people around the world who listen gives us great energy. And so if you have any feedback or comments, please let us know. And if they're positive ones, then please let your friends and family know too. All the details on how to connect with us are in the show notes or on our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com.